Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Whether you're nearing retirement, entering the workforce for the first time, or caught somewhere in the confusing muddle in the middle, you're likely sensing it and you're probably living it. We know we are, and we want to know why. Listen in as we interview experts and everyday people like you to find out how best to navigate the ever-growing weirdness of work in the modern age.
Welcome to Work is Weird Now. Today we have Sunil Malhotra. I first came across Sunil in one of those serendipitous online moments. I came across his book, Yogai. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, which is basically looks like yoga and AI smushed together. It brings together two worlds that I'm personally super interested in. So AI and its impact on work, and also yoga. As anybody who knows me knows, I'm a very keen hot yoga participant. And so always really interested in how that can bring some different applications into our work life as well. So I was really excited to see the book. I then mentioned I was reading it and enjoying it on LinkedIn and posted a picture of the book. And one of those amazing things about social media and the times where tech actually works is actually Sunil got in touch with me on the back of that. And we had a great, interesting discovery call where he really already challenged everything I'd been thinking about the potential for our discussion. And so we concluded that the focus of this episode should be something like, what if we turned everything we think about work on its head? So Sunil, can you please go ahead and just introduce yourself and maybe share something that was weird about work for you this week?
You've already introduced me as a weird guy, so that's good. Actually, I'm going to put this question back at you before I answer it. When in your life was work not weird?
True.
Very true.
Yeah, we are increasingly realizing work has always been weird.
Always weird. Yes, it's always been weird. And not so much for the reason that we don't want to work. It's just because everything has been quite crazy. The way the world is organized, the way the entire systems have been put into place. What was weird for me this week, since that was one of the questions that you did want to ask. So the two interesting things. One was that I had a meeting with somebody who actually works with the youth of India. And his main contention was that, you know, we've told them that when you're working with us or whatever you're doing, you're not supposed to use AI, right? And I said, what? This is crazy. Right? This is weirder than work is weird. And I don't know how this connects up. So I'm just leaving that there because I don't know. There is no answer to that. The other interesting one, what was weird was there's a friend of mine in the US. He's of Indian origin. And he's done some work. What's been happening of late is that why yoga is becoming more and more relevant as the days pass is because with every passing day, what people have started realizing is that we do need a new system. And we don't know what that system is going to look like, right? So that brings me to, I'll segue to the third weird thing, actually. Okay, so this guy has been in the Bhagavad Gita and the Indic systems, etc. And he read a post of mine on LinkedIn and said, well, you know, knowledge work is dying and we are in the age of wisdom. And as can be expected, his suggestion was that can we create programs to train people in wisdom? I actually wrote to him saying that, you know, I want to challenge the core assumption that wisdom can be taught. I believe wisdom cannot be taught. Wisdom is something that's emergent, and wisdom is something that comes to each individual. I don't think there is any concept in my head of collective wisdom, unless it is individual wisdom. And these individuals coming together, and then you term that as collective wisdom. Otherwise, the general tendency is, you know what, there is a general concept like knowledge. Just let's create something that feels much better and then put it together in some sort of a course and teach it to people. It's not going to happen, right?
Right.
So that was those were my two or three weird moments of the week.
Amazing. Yeah, there's lots of rich content there. So I just want to read a little bit from the intro to your book, because I think this will provide a little bit of insight into why we were so interested to have you on. So the thesis I put forth is the bold claim that yoga is the fitness regime for humans, not just to counter the perceived threat of an AI takeover, but also to co-evolve with the inorganic beings that AI will inevitably design and build without any assistance from human beings. Some call it AGI, which is obviously the agentic generative version of AI. And then you go on to say, we need to tap more into our humanness. Yoga is a path, one path that allows us to do that. So can you talk to us about why you believe that yoga is the sort of solution or the counter to what's happening with AI?
Well, this can take me a whole year to explain, but okay, I'll try.
We've got the time.
I'm sure the listeners don't have the time, but okay. Anyway, so see the general notion of what yoga is just barely the surface of yoga. So yoga actually means many, many things. The original Sanskrit word yoga, or it's actually in India, the Sanskrit word is not pronounced as yoga, it's pronounced as yog. It's just yog. There's no A. So it's got westernized where you put an A in it and then you call it yoga. It comes from the root, very interestingly, from the root yok, Y-O-K-E, and also the Sanskrit word yuj, Y-U-J. And Y-U-J actually means union. And what does union actually mean? The union means the union between yourself as an individual being, physical being, and the cosmic source which gives you life. That's actually the meaning of yoga. And yoga is used, you know, in many ways. I mean, you've heard of the Bhagavad Gita, which is Lord Krishna's advice to mankind on how to live a good life. It has 18 chapters, 700 verses and 18 chapters. And each chapter is actually called a yoga. Okay. So there are multiple uses for yoga. This is what I found out when I did research and I started writing this book, which is what fascinated me a lot. Because, you know, the initial understanding I had, and I think you've read that in the introduction as well, that my understanding of yoga also was limited to basically physical fitness and mental fitness. And I knew that, you know, pranayama or breath control was the way to connect the mind and body. But that's where it ends. But yoga actually is, I will risk calling it inner technology. See, what's happening with AI is it's the outer world being driven by exponential technologies. To be able to handle that world and to be able to handle yourself and your context in a relevant way in that world, you obviously need inner technology, which you never needed in the past, right? Because everything was given to us and everything we were all handled all the way through our lives from the time we were kids all the way till we kind of ended up, you know, wherever we ended up. I don't know. I mean, I do not go into that space. So when you look at yoga actually is a very, very wide system. I'll call it a system. But to my mind, it's the way for an individual to be able to generate inner clarity, resilience, and equanimity. These are the three things that an individual can gain by going through the gamut of yoga, which is actually, they call it Ashtanga Yoga, which is eight limbs of yoga, out of which the three we've talked about, which is physical fitness, which is asanas, pranayama, which is breath control, and meditation, which is dhyana. These are the only things that we know of. I'm not just saying that it's only in the West that you are aware of it. Mm-hmm. Everybody in India, when we speak about yoga as well, except the monks and the people who are yoga gurus, so to speak, we only think of these three. Now, in today's day and age, you need the other five as well, was my context, which is why I claim that it is the best for these times.
Hmm. I mean, it sounds similar to some of the things that we talk about, maybe in a more Western context, that relate to mindset. So you can only control what's within. You can't control the world around you. So therefore, you need to change your mindset in response to the world around you, as opposed to trying to respond to the world, you know, as it comes. Do you see that relationship, or is there something that yoga offers that goes beyond a simple shift in mindset?
I will risk saying that it goes way beyond because the word that you used was mindset. And the actual problem that human beings have is that we've become prisoners of our mind. You know, we can't transcend the mind. And the fitness that we are looking for now comes from beyond the mind. Because when if you're stuck with the mind has all these other ways of monkeying around and not letting go. Which is why in the yoga practice, when you do meditation, the focus basically is think of one thought, let go of all your thoughts. The mind thrives. The nutrition for the mind is just thoughts. And if you notice, and that's why pranayama becomes very interesting, because the way they put it is that, you know, pranayama, actually prana, let me introduce the concept of prana here. Prana doesn't mean breath. Prana means life force. And the closest connection that we can identify, feel, experience is the breath, which is why they say breath control. And one of the ways to actually test this in our own lives is that when you're anxious, when you're angry, when you're fearful, you'll find that your breath increases. I mean, the speed of your breathing increases, right? So very interestingly, what yoga says is, think of it about whether it's possible for you to reduce your breath to a certain number of counts and see if it has the opposite effect, you know, which is very fascinating. I mean, when you look at it from, I'm a scientific person, I did my engineering, I'm not a yogi, whatever, right? But at the end of it, when somebody tells you that, you know, okay, this is the symptom, this is the effect of your emotional state, and then tells you that, well, if this be the effect of your state, if A is equal to B, then B might be equal to A. I mean, it's logical, right? So if you slow your breath down consciously, chances are that you'll calm yourself down. And in the initial stages, you're quite a skeptic. You say, no, that's not possible. I mean, just because I slow my breath down doesn't mean it's going to, you know, make my fear go away. Mm-hmm. Guess what? It's magic. It does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I definitely can. I mean, I was actually talking yesterday about how I've had a lifelong fear of public speaking, maybe ironic given I'm doing this now, but always get so nervous, have a massive nervous system reaction to the idea of public speaking. And it was only when I learned breath work that I realized I actually had full control over my physical state and mental state going into a speaking engagement just by using the remote control that is for your nervous system, which is the breath. So yeah, definitely have experienced that.
There you go, Alice. I need you as testimony for yoga now.
I'm just curious, but how has the book been received? Have people understood or seen or felt the connection between yoga and AI? Or is it something where people have responded by saying, I don't, this is two things I never thought could be brought together?
So when you look at the book, right, can you see this the right way up? I'm yeah. seeing mm-hmm. it. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So you notice this word. It says interplays, right? It was a big challenge for me because whenever I spoke about yoga and I spoke to people and I got the book reviewed, etc., there is a general tendency to believe that the book actually shows you the connection between the two. It doesn't, okay? Mm. The idea of the book is that it's going to give you inside, outside, the things about the inside internal world and ways to go into the internal world. And not all. It's just, you know, starting points for each one of these. Alice, if you've seen, and Dan, if you've read even parts of the book, you probably realize that this is a very... I've actually shirked my responsibility as an author because I haven't put in my opinion. What I've done is I've mm-hmm. created hooks that you can attach yourself to and start on your own journey of self-discovery, right? So to quickly answer your question, the reception has been beyond my wildest imagination because it's gone all over the world. It's not one of those books which is, you know, which you pick up and you say, hey, this is, I can just go through this in about a week or whatever, or in 2-3 days, and now I know that I've got these 6 takeaways. It has no takeaways because it shifts the responsibility on you to find your own takeaways. And so I had to, and then actually yoga made me do this. It said, hey, don't call it connections, call it interplays, right? And my epiphany was that when you look at this book, what it's actually trying to tell you is that there is an inner world and an external world, okay? And there are these dichotomies, and there is fear outside, which you need to counter with resilience inside. But guess what? It doesn't intersect anywhere except on every individual human being. It doesn't intersect anywhere else. And so if it intersects at every individual human being, it means that everyone's solution and path and journey is going to be different, right? And so what happened is, yes, I did not I didn't put too much money behind it. I didn't want to push the book. I'm still not pushing the book because I don't think this is a book that needs to be pushed. I'm hoping that it gets pulled into the market. I've given it all that I could in terms of technology because it's self-published and also it's print on demand all over the world. But I mean, South America, Argentina, I know that one or two copies have sold. US is doing exceptionally well. UK, there are several copies, including the one that you're holding. Then you've got Ireland, Canada, Italy, Germany, Netherlands, Singapore, Australia, India, a few more countries, Bangkok, Thailand, okay? And what's happening is that with more and more anxiety, more and more exponentiality happening, the book is becoming more and more relevant because people are looking for answers. And some people, I think most people who have read it, have figured out that the answers are within. And the book shows that. You'll find several places where you'll just get stuck on one particular question, and that will be the question that you're looking for an answer for. And I'm hoping that it will show you a path. You don't need to come back to the author. It will show you a path to take off from there and embark on your own journey.
It certainly sounds like it's a book that you wanted to be found, like when somebody's in need of it. Not, like you say, it's not for that big marketing push. It's very much, you use the word pull, but I think when people, sometimes people are actively looking for something and it feels like that book that needs to be almost found and picked up. And we've all had that moment with a book, right? It just feels like it was meant to be at that time, like somebody's given it to you or you've picked it up. It's one of those for sure. And you definitely said earlier that this is not you, it's you almost guiding, advising, but it's not your personal opinion. It's you pulling together these pieces. What is your heartfelt opinion around this topic?
It might even sound fantastical or phantasmagical, whatever, right? Because what it's done is it's actually, so let me see if I can quickly read out something I put on. Yeah, okay. So this, very quickly, I'll just read this out. I stayed away from inserting overt ideas or opinions into yoga, preferring instead to create space for readers to arrive at their own insights. The process of writing has quietly reshaped how I think. Oddly enough, yoga has become a lens, subtle yet persistent, through which new ways of seeing have emerged in me.
Can you describe some of those ways of the new ways of seeing?
One was an example during a discovery call. Because when I'm asked a question, I don't come with a preconceived idea of the experience that I have. In fact, what I had on my LinkedIn profile for the longest time said that experience is the suitcase that we carry all the junk we've collected throughout our lives, yeah. Right? And now the time has come where that's actually true. And so one of the things it's told me, so I don't know who, I saw something on LinkedIn or on some other social media post where somebody was writing that you can't pour anything out from an empty cup, right? And my response to that was, you can't pour anything into a cup that's already full. Okay, so now this is not coming from something that's guided from the mind, from thoughts, from training. So I give a lot of credit now to the cosmos. That's why I said it may sound very fantastical, because now I've understood that everything that I'm saying today or I've written or I'm starting to do now is not coming from me, but coming through me. And that's a big shift. Because when you can decide that you're an instrument, then you really don't need to worry about what comes out. You don't judge good or bad coming through you, right? So if I'm saying something to you, whether you take it well or you don't take it well, it just came through me. I wasn't telling you anything.
So let's leave the baggage of experience behind and turn our focus then to the world of work. And obviously, the work system that we've built is very much based on an enormous amount of baggage that we've carried around since the beginning of time, but certainly since the Industrial Revolution. And we are all signed up to a form of work that is based on this baggage. So when we discuss this question, what if we turned everything on its head? I assume looking at that question, you're looking at it through this new view of yoga and the cosmos. Where would we start?
I was having a chat with somebody. I met somebody last week. And I've, my pet peeve these days is the education system. My belief is that education is the villain of the piece. And if you don't change education, nothing is going to change. Right? And I've heard, I've been thrown this question several times. Okay, then you tell us what, if we don't have this existing system, what's the new system? So I said, I'm as clueless about it as you are. The only point I'm trying to make is that I'm not judging or criticizing the system. All I'm saying is I see it's not working. And I see that it's not going to work in the future. So I said, unless we take the hard call to dump it, we will never know what's going to be new. The next question I hear is, but how can we dump something unless we know if there's something else that we need to take? So I'm sorry, but pardon my French, but what I told this gentleman was, I said, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. I said, you're telling me that you're willing to go with mediocrity and baggage just because you don't have an alternative, which you don't want to work on. You want somebody else to come and replace it for you. Right? And if you look at it from that lens, the question then becomes, now let's bring both these pieces together, the empty cup and the fact that you can't discard what you already have. So this is basically, it's a sunk cost fallacy, right? I already have this system. I've got all these people in place. I've been educated by the same system. So I'll give you a very quick example. I was invited for a talk where there were these about 60 or 70 ladies who were basically grandmothers about our age or maybe even older, right? And they loved the talk. But then one of them asked this question saying that, well, you're saying that the education system should be flipped. But then what happens? How, that means your kids don't go to school? I said, yeah, they don't go to school. They said, but then how do they get into university? I said, you're presuming that a university needs to be there. Supposing there are no universities. So she says, she goes, no. But at the end of the day, that's what it is. You need to go through 12 years of schooling. Then you need to go into university, right? There is no other system in place. I said, tell me one thing. How does a two-year-old child learn to speak your language? So she said, yeah, I mean, she just he or she just picks up the language. And I said, tell me, is the grammar okay or not? Is the person, the kid able to communicate with you? Yes. Is the sentence okay? Yes. Is the grammar fine? Yes. And I said, when the kid becomes 3 and a half, you take him and put him into school, right? And by the time the kid is 6 years old, he neither knows the words, he only know, he can recite the alphabet. He wonders what these words mean. Then you teach him meaning. Then you teach him grammar. And at the end of it, he doesn't know the language because he can make sentences but cannot communicate at all. Now, why I gave you this story is that supposing we wanted to look at the workplace today, it's completely top-down hierarchical. And again, pardon my French, it's all been designed and is being run by pale, male, and stale folks.
Couldn't agree more.
So you've got three attributes there. Pale, okay, so let's get rid of the pale. Male, let's get rid of the male. And stale, you need fresh blood coming in, right? So my question would be that, let's segue into the workspace now. You have a top-down, hierarchical, rule-based order. Can we have a social order which is driven purely by the so-called employees? And we need a new lexicon. Because I remember in 2013, 12 or 13, I had written a piece. In fact, I wrote a white paper for the European Knowledge Board where I had mentioned that we need to change this entire lexicon, the dictionary of organizations. I said, you say human resources. Why will you not treat human beings as resources if you just call them resources, right? So you have to change the way you think. So one of the things that we need to do, how do we change? I mean, even if I did have some answers, I think I'd be doing exactly, I would not be eating my own dog food if I were to tell you this is how we should do it, because we're not replacing a system. So I think the first step would be, how do we hospice and get rid of the existing culture? Right? So which means the cup is full right now. How do we empty it? Can we flip it over? You know, that's the metaphor. Can we flip it over, get rid of everything, right? And which means what? Which means that you don't have some boss who's sitting and enabling and empowering you. You use yoga and such indigenous techniques, start becoming more and more comfortable in your own skin, start understanding that you need to start taking responsibility instead of shifting the blame to the system or to people, right? And show up at work every day, not worrying about whether you're doing the right thing or not. As long as you're having a good time and doing what your heart is telling you to do, just keep doing it. And if you did that and started it as an experiment with just four people, with the way technology enablement exists today, who knows, you might be building the organization of the future that's not even dependent on the economic framework that we currently go towards. You know, GDP is the wrong way to look at progress, right? And it's education and the economic framework. If these two get destroyed, humanity and the planet would be much happier is the way I look at it. And COVID showed us that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting when you talk about the education system, because we've been talking about that quite a lot as well. As you can imagine, when we talk about work, we often end up talking about education because it's what primed us for this world of work. Yeah. And it's the way that you're describing it makes me think, especially in terms of two-year-old language acquisition and things like that, we are sort of systematically stripping away the humanness from the person, right, through education and work.
Yes.
So we are very much focused on the mind and the knowledge. And what's interesting about the AI revolution is that it's going to take that piece away from us potentially, which gives us sort of two options. The first option is that we panic and we fight it and we try to retain some control over that knowledge and that whole thinking piece. Or we give in to that piece potentially being gone and we redefine intelligence to be something much more human that touches all aspects of who we are. Am I describing the kind of world that you would, that we're talking about here in your mind?
See, one is that the fear that we face is natural. It's not psychological, it's not emotional, it's biological. Hmm. And the culprit is the amygdala, which has not evolved for the last 50,000 years from the hunter-gatherer days when there was a rustle in the bushes. I had to make a choice on whether I would fight that or run away. So fight or flight. Now, what's happening is two things are happening. Right now, the amygdala is not able to handle the shift from linear to exponential, right? Because linear is predictable. Exponential is not. And we've across the linear, so our pace of learning is always going to remain linear because that's how the human organism has been designed. You cannot become exponential. Evolution doesn't allow it. Okay, so now if you are going to be a linear person in an exponential world, how are you going to handle it? So one of the things is that we are scared that intelligence is something that silicon is competing with the brain or the biological system, right? And it's already proven that it's far superior. It's quicker, it doesn't have moods, it doesn't have emotions, all the fallibility things that human beings have, which can actually become our strengths, right? But we are pushing them aside. We are just using brute force, the typical male pale and stale attitude. This guy is coming at me, let me go back and hit him. Right? So I'd shift the word intelligence. I would hand over the entire intelligence. Now, that's a can of worms, Alice, Dan, because, you know, intelligence does not have a commonly agreed to definition as of today, right? And one of the biggest culprits of that is this scientific temper, because everything has to be evidence-based. We are all machines. Everything will be done by analysis and we reduce ourselves down to parts. And so now I have this brain. Have you people heard of, you live in the same neck of the woods. You've heard of Satish Kumar, Schumacher College?
No.
You must look him up. In fact, you should interview him also. I don't know if it fits this format or this mandate or not. But he's a very interesting gentleman. He walked for peace 8,000 miles from India to Washington in 2.5 years.
Wow.
Without any money. Okay. Now, he runs what is called Schumacher College, and he had done a talk at the London School of Economics a few years back. And what he started his talk by saying, the problem that we have, not started, somewhere in the early part of his talk, he said, The problem with our education system, which then carries forward, like you said, because that's what primes us for our lives, is that we teach only the head and only half of the head. We only teach the left half of the head, right? There's the other half of the head that needs to be taught. So he came up and he's written a book called Education by Head, Heart and Hands. That's holistic education. So my sense is that, coming back to answering your question, let's leave intelligence to the new inorganic beings or AI or whatever we talk about. And let's pick all the human things, the so-called fallible traits of human beings. Let's amplify them.
Right.
Let's make sure that we are connecting with each other. Let's make sure that we cry. Let's make sure that we are fighting with each other, you know, not with them. Let's fight amongst each other, debate, figure out what it is. So I would suggest, my suggestion would be, see, one of the things is that the brain has to be, it's neuroplastic and needs to be rewired. We need to get rid of these terms. So get rid of intelligence for human beings and call it wisdom. And let's just keep going towards wisdom. I promise you, not in our lifetimes or in our children's or our grandchildren's lifetimes will there be any wisdom coming outside of the human species. It doesn't come, right? So as long as we take the wisdom part of it, and let's not try to analyze it and break it down. Hey, you know, we've got creativity, we've got judgment, we've got decision making. Again, what you're trying to do is you're taking this whole basket and making it a binary, you know, let's divvy it up between our competitors, so-called competitors and us. Because we've got used to, in the industrial economy, industrial age, we've got used to a zero-sum thinking, and it's all a zero-sum game. If you win, I lose. What if we can all win, you know? And I use ChatGPT, I use a lot of AI tools on myself, because I think they are fantastic assistants. Absolutely fantastic. I'd like to tell them that they're even better than assistants, because they're not, they don't have moods. They are very respectful. They don't fight with me, you know.
Mm-hmm. Very
it's
patient.
It's a teammate. It's a soundboard. You know, it's using it for its advantage. And it's like, you say all of those other things, wisdom, experience, curiosity, connection, empathy, all of those things that we collect through connection are just so valuable. And it keeps coming through in the education chats that we're talking about. I suppose my question is, if we don't change how we work, then what do you feel AI is about to accelerate or expose?
First of all, all the jobs from the industrial age. So let's look at it like this. We had a great system. It served us really well for the times, right? Now, when you have somebody who you have lived with, your partner, let's say, right? And that person reaches end of life. What do? Do you kick it in its butt and say, why are you so old? Right? Do you do that to your partner? Right? Or do you just leave him or her lying by the wayside and go and pick another partner? No, that's not a human thing to do. What you do is you take it, you hospice it, you give it dignity, you have this feeling that you're giving it enough respect and gratitude for what it's been able to do, right? Mm-hmm. And let it go peacefully so that the new can unfold. We need to do that, because then to your question, if we don't do that, all the jobs that were there at the industrial age, I mean, 90%, I'll just use a percentage at random, 80, 90% of the jobs were basically using human beings as machines, right? They were all repetitive. I will pay you so much per hour. Even today, the consulting is done on a per hour basis. Human beings are not machines that you charge on a per hour basis. Okay, so I'm 40 years old. This guy is 40 years old. So my rate, hourly rate should be the same as that guy, because our education is the same. We are not grading material, right? So what we need to do probably is to understand that all these jobs are gone. And there may not be any more jobs with a monthly paycheck. So what will you do? Right? So will a lot of people in the binary mode will say, oh, so then we all need to become entrepreneurs. I don't know. Are there grays in between? There might be. We had the gig economy. It's still going on. And guess what? The beauty of this entire AI play today, the way I look at it, is till now, every technology was going after the blue-collar jobs, the low-skill jobs, right? And AI has come after the people that believe that they could create these jobs. right? So now what's going to happen, very strangely, this is a prediction, I don't normally make predictions, is that the worst affected are going to be the top guys, the guys that are highly educated, the people who are so-called supposed to be at the top. And AI is not going to touch the low-skilled workers at all because it won't make sense. The baggage handler at an airport, why would you automate that beyond what it is today, right? So those guys will keep their jobs. AI is not affecting them. So why I said let's flip the equation is because all these things are evident now. Mm. And 1 year from now, 2 years from now, I mean, even 2 years from now is difficult to predict the way ChatGPT happened, DeepSeek happened, etc. You really don't know when things are going to flip. And so what's playing in my head is this. So let's say, let's look at an organization today. This will be a fun thing to do, though. You have, let's say, three layers, right? You have a senior management CXO layer below the board. It's that pyramid, right? Then you have the middle management. And then you have these lower down guys. These are all white collar, by the way. These are all knowledge workers. That's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about factory settings at all. And most of our workforce today is in this space because technology, digital technology, we are in a digital world today. Now, with AI coming in, it's much easier for a middle manager today to replace his junior or her junior with AI. Am I right? Mm-hmm. Which means those jobs are all going to go away. Okay. But guess what? While this is happening, 2 years down the line, these guys are going to become senior, which means that the jobs of the middle manager is going to go away. Mm-hmm. And so you will be left with AI and top management. And when they retire, poof, all organizations are gone.
Right.
It's a thought experiment. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And that's why I said we can have some fun.
Yeah.
And see what happens.
Have we thought about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, that gets back to the core question of what is the value of work to human beings?
No, AI, pardon the cliche, but I have not worked a single day in my life. And I think you will believe it after having spoken to me.
Yeah. When you were a four-year-old, when you were a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I knew this was coming.
Too predictable, but I'll take it.
So I was very fortunate. I was very fortunate. I grew up, in a very evolved, progressive family. They didn't straitjacket me into something. They put me into a missionary school, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Now, as long as you're in high school, especially in India, you really don't think about very much beyond getting into a higher educational institution. In my days, it used to be you can either become a doctor or you can become a lawyer or you can become an engineer. These were the three choices we had, right? And that totally in our system, it's borrowed from, it's the same British system that we inherited. And so the cream of the cream would actually end up doing either engineering or medicine, and the other people would then go into bachelors of science and commerce and law and stuff like that. So the first time I really had to make a decision about what I wanted to do, I don't think I was the kind of child or all through my school that I ever had some sort of a dream about this is what I would become, because my way of looking at life was, let me enjoy what I'm doing right now. Let me learn as much as I can. And we'll see how it plays out. This might be soul maturity or whatever. When you look at the Indian Indic systems, you kind of think of reincarnation and things. They do have a concept of soul maturity. So that's why I say I was fortunate that I really didn't, And my cohort also were not really busy thinking about, I want to be a pilot or an astronaut or whatever. We never had those dreams. Also, this was very soon, just barely 15-20 years after the country got partitioned. So there were still the remnants of the British. We were still, my family comes from a displaced background, etc., and they still did very well for themselves. So when I came, I went into technology and I studied engineering or whatever. And I was very fortunate again that I went into a college that allowed us a lot of freedom to discover our own true potential. And I started having so much fun that I never bothered about what I wanted to be, because I realized that I could go through life just doing what I enjoyed doing. Hmm. So, but this is not the rule, right? So I'm sorry.
No, it's actually a lovely way to turn it on its head, because I think we're almost... were asked the question from such a young age, it's almost like you have to make a choice, and then you have to choose certain subjects at certain ages. You know, your things start, you do GCSEs here and then into A-levels, and it narrows and you're almost channeled to make this choice. And some of it's at such a young age, like choose what you want to be at the age of 13 or whatever. And some people really know, and I admire that. But for others, is there a choice to just let creativity and curiosity guide you in that way? That for me feels so much more refreshing. I'd, you know, love to put that option on the table for my kids. It feels like a different way to look at work and flip work on its head.
So I need to look back now to the cultural dimensions, because, you know, the Indian society, because of the Vedic values that have percolated all the way down for the 4,000-5,000 years, whether we articulate it or not, we do have, I think, subconsciously, we do have this feeling of interconnectedness, which is why the family bonds and the extended family are very, very strong without really working at it, right? And that's a kind of mega safety net. So, Dan, I agree with you. I mean, I know how it is, how competitive it is in the Western world, because, you know, you've got to fend for yourself by the time you're 15, 13, 14, 15, or whatever it is. So better pick, right? The sad part is that despite India having this kind of a culture, most people don't choose it. They still choose to go the Western way. Okay, I need to be competitive. I need to go do this, do a PhD, go to the US. Many of these people show up in the US, and you can see that today. You can see the big tech companies are headed by people of Indian origin, right? They're not Indians by any standards, but they come from that same cultural makeup. And it's complex. What we're talking about is very complex.
I didn't actually know the acronym for WEIRD, which is obviously interesting in the context of the name of our podcast, but I'll just read it. It's Western, Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic. And obviously that has been a really dominant world approach and has certainly played a big part in bringing about AI. And I think what was so interesting to me about the topic of this book, beyond all the things we've already mentioned, is this idea that AI is so cutting edge, and yet yoga is something that is ancient and has been around since the beginning of time, effectively. And so actually to connect these two things together, to go backwards, to go forwards, is a really interesting concept. Do you think it's time for us to look at some of those philosophies that we've maybe treated almost as a sideshow, but actually look at them in a more holistic view moving forward?
We don't have a choice. Mm-hmm. From my point of view, we don't have a choice. That's why it's like a homecoming. You have to go back, because who is it that you know the best is yourself. Who is it that you've gone furthest away from? Yourself. Because we've only looked at the outside. The whole quest of humanity is defining progress as something on the outside. There's no training. See, one of the things I think I'm very happy and I'm grateful that I got the opportunity to do is to bring this kind of a thought process mainstream. The fact that you're talking about it and saying, is this the way it goes back? I think my job is already done. See, I've mentioned in the book, Alice, I don't know if you've read that part. We have two priesthoods. Right? You have the yoga priesthood, which is Sanskrit and it's written in aphorisms and is retained by the Brahmins or the monks, so-called people, because that's their livelihood. I mean, why would they demystify it? Why would they democratize it, right? And the other priesthood is the technology priesthood. AI, why would they democratize it? So that's why you've got both these, one sitting in India and the other sitting in the US, right?
Both impossible which are fiercely, to understand.
Yeah, they want to make it impossible to understand. Mm-hmm. Which is why I think yoga can do a great job by demystifying and actually unfolding what's going on. And it's not so difficult, you know. It's till you dip your toes in the water, you cannot figure out what the temperature is. And so I think, you know, once you have things like these books like Yoga coming out, you know, one of the things that I shouldn't be so judgmental and critical, but what I'm finding is that, you know, the quickest opportunity that people are finding, especially people who are educated in both traditions, are saying, hey, you know what, let me take this ancient Indian wisdom, there's so much of it there, let me pick a small piece and see how to apply it to the world. So Bhagavad Gita for managers, Bhagavad Gita for doing this, and yoga for doing this, you know, here are six steps, just do this. I wonder why is it that the self-help books, I mean, if you go into any traditional physical bookstore, or I don't know if that holds true on digital bookstores as well, the maximum number of books are self-help books. How come they don't live up to their promise? They don't.
Is that your next book then?
Everybody's writing, sorry?
Book then, practical tips for...
No. I'm staying away from that. That's, you know, it took me more than 3 years to write this book. It was because I wanted to stay away from doing that. That was the easy thing for me to do. In fact, if I went about doing that, I could actually turn out a book every 6 months.
Yeah. Well, just to make you really uncomfortable, then I'll ask you our last question, which is what would be your advice to people and organizations kind of moving forward in this world of AI? What would you suggest they do to maybe bring some relief from that anxiety?
So let me close the loop on that, on the question that Dan asked, right? About, so I'm basically both of you, about what is this yogic shift in governance as organizations, right? What do you mean by flipping the whole thing? I believe, and you asked me, is that the way to go? And I said, there is no other choice from my point of view, right? So let me read out what I've written. I said, it's better that I read out something so that it's clear. Top-down governance, much like traditional science, relies on average, and systems are designed for the typical citizen or employee. But just as modern personality research now sees that that variation is valuable data, governance too must evolve. So it's that individualization that we need to focus on. The future lies in an individual-centered model built from the inside out, from the individual outward. I spoke about this in the discovery call as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Through yoga, individuals cultivate inner resilience, clarity, and self-regulation. That's a very critical part because it's part of discipline. When you do yoga or you go through this, you realize that you have a responsibility and you understand without using your mind what discipline really means. How much of that discipline applies to you? How much does it apply to the fact that you don't need to tread on other people's toes? How much does it apply to not taking more than you need? That kind of stuff, right? And I'm saying this from personal experience. This is not read stuff. This is personal experience. This is one of the things that happened with me, Dan, through the journey of writing Yoga and thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
These grounded individuals, these few grounded individuals can then form conscious communities rooted in shared values, capable of self-governance without external control. This is a shift from imposed order to emergent harmony, where governance grows not from the top, but from the strength of each individual. Yoga is the catalyst. The noise becomes the signal. Averages give way to authenticity. This is not a fix or a framework. It's not a return to ancient models or an upgrade to modern systems. It's an emergence, subtle, grounded, arising from within the living present. Yoga is the soil and not the system. So you asked me about what I would suggest. I normally don't give people any tips or options, but for leaders, I just want to tell, because I've been a leader myself, I hope I have been. I don't call myself a leader, but I've been able to run a company successfully. I've been able to do a lot of stuff in my life. Also, it's part of the junk I carry in my suitcase. So that disclaimer in place. So true leadership isn't about directing or commanding, but rather about inspiring, empowering, and enabling others to lead themselves. So when the mantra we had at Idea Farms in the early days, when HR, again, I'm using the word HR because that's the lexicon that we also had to use. When these people used to come and say, Sunil, how do we hire people? So, you know, in software and design in tech companies, you typically have a test they go through, et cetera, et cetera. So you're basically hiring resumes and not people.
Mm-hmm.
So I flipped that and I told them, just remember this, write it down and remember it all the time. Hire people for what they want to do and then let them do it. That's it. Very simple mantra. Just hire people. So your interview should be, what do you want to do? What do you want to do in your life? Oh, so I've done this, I've done this. Leave that aside. I don't want to know what you did, where you've come from. I want to understand, what do you want to do? I will create the opportunity for you to do it, and I will let you do it. That's it. Okay, this is for leaders. And for people, because I'm talking about yoga, and this is my plug into my book as well, is to say, be self-directed. Don't wait for people to tell you what to do. Don't look for a set of KRAs that you're hitting. Show up every morning because you want to, because you're spending the larger part of your life in your with your work, whatever you call so-called work, right? You're spending the largest part of your day or your life doing that. So just show up, enjoy yourself to the maximum. Don't give yourself too much stress so that you have to go to a doctor for blood pressure medication. And when you're not happy, leave. So I used to say this to each one of the people that work for me, saying, if you're coming into Idea Farms, come because you want to come here. The day you don't feel like coming, don't come. I'll make sure your salary is sent home.
I wish somebody would have said that to me.
It made me feel quite emotional. That's honestly made me feel quite emotional. Honestly, it's just, yeah, wow, what phenomenal advice. Thank you.
No, but that's actually a trick, you know, because you've shifted the responsibility back on the employee.
Yeah. But yeah, it's so powerful. So powerful.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Thank you so much, Sunil. We really, really appreciate you being
here. I should thank you for doing this because, you know, this is the way yoga gets to people and makes a difference to them.
Yeah. So how obviously you can get the book on all of
on Amazon.
Amazon, yeah. And how can people get in touch with you if that's something that you're open to?
I'm open to it. You have my email ID. If you'd like to share it, please go ahead. Mm-hmm. I prefer you don't share it on LinkedIn and on platforms. Yeah. But if there's somebody that wants to get in touch with me who you know or reaches out to you, feel mm-hmm. free. I'm on LinkedIn, you know that. Both of you know where to find me on LinkedIn. And that's probably the best place because that's the most serious for... But otherwise, I'm open. I mean, I've got time on my hands and I don't care if people waste it. Like I said, I always look at an opportunity as something that gives me the chance for something from the cosmos to come through me. So I'm happy to, you know, be the conduit.
Fantastic. And everyone go out and get the book because it really is a stunning piece of work and it's just elicited all sorts of fresh thinking from me. So yeah, I appreciate it so much. So thank you and have a good rest of your day.